Hey, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm super excited for this week's show. It's Rex Manning Day, which means we are talking about Empire Records. I'm joined for this very special conversation by Rob DiCristino. Hi, Rob.
Patrick, it's Rex Manning Day.
For the record, we know it's not actually Rex Manning
Day. I know there's an official Rex Manning Day, but for us, it's Rex Manning Day.
That people like celebrate on Twitter.
I know.
I am going to be a garbage person on this episode.
I know. People are all excited. They're like, wow, they're finally doing Empire Records. This is going to be so great. And then it's just going to be Patrick shitting on it for an hour.
Oh, I'm going to try to.
No, it's okay. I think
stay positive.
I'm sure we'll get into this, but this was my idea, everybody, because I love Empire Records, knowing that it's not a good movie. But
I love the idea of Empire Records.
Yes, and but... I think there's lots of reasons why this went the way it did, and we'll talk about it.
This is our first like proper show in a long time because we've been doing all of our year end and best of stuff, so we haven't done like a. Have you seen anything good lately in a while? So, Rob, have you seen anything good lately?
I saw Plane. Plane was good.
You did. You wrote a review of Plane really at FThisMovie.com, and it really made me want to see it. I was going to try to squeeze in a showing last Friday, and I just have been too busy. But
Plane's super good, everybody.
Yeah, I'm really excited for Plane.
A lot of people have seen it. It's a really good Redbox movie to see on the big screen. No, you can read my review about that. And then the other one, so Alice Darling, which comes out this week.
Yes.
And when this podcast comes out, you will not yet have read my review, right?
It'll be out this afternoon. Actually.
This afternoon. So depending on when, if you're a wake and bake, like if you're an FS movie, you know, like I wake up right away.
Which some people are.
And I got to listen to F This Movie. We love you. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely.
I got to listen to F This Movie right away, first thing in the morning. Then you will not have read this yet. But more than likely, later on today, you can log on and read my review of Alice Darling, starring my beloved Anna Kendrick. It's not great. it's about 2/3 of a movie. I get into this in my review, but the sort of most curious thing about it is that it sort of sets itself up to be this sort of noir-y kind of revenge, you know, woman revenge thing against a sort of abusive boyfriend, and then it ends. It skips the third act. It's something I've never seen before in a movie like this, which is, I mean, the movie just literally doesn't have a third act. You think it's going to build somewhere and then the movie ends. I'm not sure if that was an issue with the editing. I don't really know. And this movie comes out this week, and I'm curious to see how it's positioned and what some of the other reviews so far have said. I haven't really read too many other reviews of it yet, but I did not love Alice Darling. I like the idea of the movie. I think Kendrick is playing a spin on the sort of quirky kind of acerbic character that she plays in more or less every movie, where she's kind of doing something that's a little bit more desperate. She's a little bit more out of control in the role. She's typically snarky and she's evasive and stuff like that. This one, she's kind of falling apart. So I like her. I like what she's trying to do in this movie. I just don't think there's enough movie there for her to really do anything with it.
Is this one of those, like the day it comes out, it'll be limited release and VOD?
I believe, yes. I was sent a thing about this, and I think it's probably at the bottom of the review. It comes out, I think this is exclusively in AMC for theatrical.
Oh, okay.
And then it's also on VOD the same day.
Okay.
I'm almost positive.
Usually I got like, at least 6 emails about screeners, and usually when I get that many emails, it's a movie that's going to VOD.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I flagged it right away. Obviously, I'll be honest, folks. I saw this movie like a month ago. I'm really only bringing it up now because I have so little to talk about. But my review does run this week. It's something I saw and wrote about forever ago. And then because they were the screeners came around really early, and I didn't realize that the release wasn't until this week. So
yeah, that's wild.
But obviously I had to check in on Anna and see what's going on. And The answer is not much.
I stupidly skipped out. I got an email asking me if I wanted a screener for The Old Way, which is the new Western starring Nicolas Cage.
Yeah.
And I stupidly was like, no, no, no. I want to support my boy. I'll wait till the day it comes out, knowing that it would go to VOD, expecting it to be one of these $5.99 titles because all of his other movies have been. And it's a right. fucking $20 rental. So now I have to wait until my boy's price drops.
Hey, he's back now. Come on, you gotta support him.
Yeah, I really want to see it. He's never made a Western. I'm excited for it, but $20 is a little stiff right now.
A little steep, Nick.
Yeah.
A little steep. Yeah. The only other thing I'll mention is one thing I was really waiting for, which was HBO's The Last of Us, came out as of last night, as of this recording. To pregame that, I put out a little thing on Twitter. I wanted to pregame it with some post-apocalyptic stuff that I had never seen before. I wanted some sort of underseen stuff. And I was suggested by someone whose name I will pull up in a second, but I was suggested 1985's New Zealand film The Quiet Earth. Patrick, are you familiar with The Quiet Earth?
I feel like I know the title and that's it.
Okay, so The Quiet Earth is, it's got that KiwiCore thing. It's got that sort of post, it feels like it was, you know, post Mad Max kind of influx
right.
of indie Australian and New Zealand films and stuff like that. It was made for something like $400,000. And it is essentially a Last Man on Earth type deal. Dan Duty recommended it to me. Thank you, Dan Duty.
Yeah.
It's fun. It's kind of the first act is just this one lead character played by Bruno Lawrence, who finds out that he's, for reasons that they get into, basically last man on Earth. He gradually meets up with two other characters, a woman played by Allison Rutledge, and then another man played by Pete Smith. This is basically the core cast. It's just the three of them. And there's some sort of scientific anomaly that happens that causes them to basically be the last people alive. There's some love triangle stuff. There's some betrayal. There's some scientific speculation. What's cool about it, and I don't think this spoils anything necessarily, but what I thought was cool about it that stood out was the characters eventually discover that it might be a spoiler. So if you skip ahead, hit your little 45-second button on your podcatcher if you don't want to hear. Essentially what they find out is that the three of them survived because when the thing happened, they were all in the moment of death. That essentially like they were all like one guy. They had all like entered the median space between life and death. Like their death happened right as this event happened. So it caused them to not die.
Okay.
The movie doesn't really have the time or space to really get into what that means. There's a really interesting, ambiguous final moment. I thought that was a cool enough idea to justify a little low budget, you know, sci-fi movie. There's some fun stuff. There's a bit with Bruno Lawrence, who's really good in this movie. Where it's a lot of the early, it's kind of that Zombieland thing where he's sort of losing his mind, but being alone.
Yeah.
You know, and there's some funny stuff in there. I don't know. It was cool. It was definitely, you know, again, Dan, thanks for the recommendation. It was pretty cool to watch. You know, definitely reminded me that kind of warm, let you get that warm feeling when you're watching an indie movie like this, where you can tell it's made for no money, but there's a lot of passion and a lot of inventiveness. Ultimately, you know, I think it's based on a novel, and I think that's maybe what I would have rather had there.
Read the novel?
Feel like maybe the novel,
okay.
There's a little bit more, you know, there's a little bit more meat on the bones.
Right.
I would think,
right.
Not having read it, but it was fun. Quiet Earth.
All right. I think I was confusing that with The Quiet American starring Michael Caine.
Okay.
Which came out 20 years after that movie, and
but, you know,
is not post-apocalyptic or science fiction or from New Zealand. So what the fuck was I thinking? I don't know.
A completely different movie.
I'm very sorry, everyone.
Quiet Earth was fun.
Good. Right on.
What do you got? What do you got? What do you got?
What do I got?
What do you got?
I've been watching a lot of Ruggiero Deodato movies because he recently passed away. And I've been working my way through his entire filmography, either for a couple of first time viewings. A lot of them have been repeat viewings, but one that I saw for the first time is his 1993 movie called The Washing Machine, which doesn't appear to be available on disc, but it's a cheap rental in HD on Amazon. And it's essentially about a girl finds a dead body in her washing machine. A cop begins to investigate. The woman and her two sisters all take turns trying to fuck him. And that's basically the entire movie.
Patrick, there are boobies on this poster.
It is.
You very rarely get poster boobies.
There are boobies in this movie. It is a bananas movie. It's not, I wouldn't call it like upper tier Diodato, but I don't care because it's so trashy and so much fun that I really enjoyed watching it. And again, I think I watched it like just after watching Jungle Holocaust, which was deeply unpleasant. It's one of his cannibal movies and really hard to get through. So to then put on sort of his answer to, you know, a 90s erotic thriller.
I was gonna say, is it like a fuck noir?
yeah, basically. And in that regard, it is glorious. It is really, really entertaining. I know Severin put out an announcement today that said that they were going to be releasing at least one more Diodato title this year. And I was like, ooh, please be The Washing Machine, because I need to own it physically.
Is that one? So, I mean, again, I've seen Cannibal Holocaust. I don't ever want to watch it again like anybody else. What else should I look for in his filmography? What are the highlights?
The Barbarians is super fun. That's on Amazon Prime. Mm-hmm. Live Like a Cop, Die Like a Man is his.
Got it.
Poliziotteschi, or I don't remember how they say that word, but there's a whole word for Italian cop movies, and that is his answer to that, and it is amazing.
Okay.
I think Cannibal Holocaust, you know, I get not wanting to ever watch it again, but I also think it's kind of a masterpiece.
Not shit talking it, just saying like,
yeah,
one and done.
Yeah, understood. I think Cut and Run is pretty good. That's like a weird mix of Italian cannibal movie and 80s action movie with Willie Ames.
He really did hit every genre.
He kind of did, yeah. He was often considered a horror director, but he made all kinds of movies.
Yeah.
Which he kind of talks about. There's a documentary it's a bonus feature on a Severin disc that I don't own, but it is also streaming on Tubi, called Diodato Holocaust. And he kind of says, like, they call me a horror director, but I made everything. And
I was about to say, I recently watched The Barbarians, not remembering.
Very nice.
That was, yes. Okay. Because when you mentioned that, I pulled it up on Wikipedia. I was like, oh, no, wait, I've seen this. okay. Excellent.
Yeah.
And most of his stuff is available streaming somewhere or other.
Yeah. Tubi has a lot of it for free.
Right.
Barbarians was streaming on Prime. Live Like a Cop, Die Like a Man. If you have a Canopy account, which all you need is a library card for, you can watch that on Canopy.
My library doesn't have Canopy.
Really?
It's one of those things where like you put in your library code or whatever, and it's just like, no, Canopy's not available. I was like, oh. Well,
that's some bullshit.
Yeah, it is some bullshit.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Go on, libraries. Look, all the money getting funneled toward America's libraries, and you can't have Canopy. Come on, take some of that slush fund money that libraries in America have and put it to good use.
It is 99 cents to rent on Amazon.
It's old.
Yeah, or $2.99 to buy in standard def. But but 99 cents to rent it is
that sounds
pretty worth it. It's one of those movies that has all like the opening motorcycle chase. You're wondering how many people were actually killed during the opening chase because laws were different in Italy.
Laws were different slash not followed.
Right. So that's pretty amazing.
Awesome.
I saw Sick, the new slasher movie from director John Hyams and co-writer Kevin Williamson, which just started streaming on Peacock. I've been hearing really good things about it. People that saw it at festivals. I want to say it played maybe Fantastic Fest last year, and people keep telling me, you know, put it on your radar. And then last week, out of nowhere, it was like, oh, by the way, it's coming to Peacock on Friday. Right on. Thank you. It's like 80 minutes. Love that.
Love it.
It's basically about two best friends who it's set during COVID, which was, I don't want to say hard to watch, but there are a lot of like specific signifiers of like, it opens with a guy in the grocery store and there's no toilet paper and he comes home and he has to wipe down all his groceries. And it's all this stuff that like, maybe we're not totally doing anymore. And you're like, geez, remember that? That was awful. And like the mask thing is different. You know, people are still wearing masks and I get that and I support that. So I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to handle like an entire movie set at the height of COVID, because I think it takes place in 2020. And then all of a sudden it stops being a COVID movie and it's just about these two girls at a cabin being chased by a masked killer. And I was like, well, where did all the COVID shit go? It does tie it all together. I had a lot of fun with it. It's not the best Kevin Williamson script. It maybe borrows a little too heavily from Scream. Like he's plagiarizing himself just a little bit. But John Hyams directs the shit out of it, as he is known to do. And I'm a big fan of, wait for it, Gideon Adlin, who's Pamela Adlin's daughter and plays the lead in the movie. She's probably best known for Blockers, I want to say. Is that right?
One of the kids in Blockers? One of the
she
girls?
Is.
Yeah.
And I don't
who would she be? One of the moms? Like,
I don't think she's in a ton else. Okay. She was on the Thing About Pam, that NBC show about with Renee Zellweger, who will come up again.
She will.
She has a fairly lengthy resume, but I know her best from Blockers. But she's really good in the movie. Everybody's really good in the movie. Cool. I would advise you not to read the plot description if you're going to watch it on Peacock. Like, just pull it up and press play. Don't look at anything on the screen, because it mentions a couple of cast members who I didn't know were in the movie until they showed up. And it's better to watch it that way.
Is it Matt Damon? Is Matt Damon?
It's Matt Damon. Show up in the movie? He does a cameo.
You know what's really funny is you mentioned the COVID movie thing and movies. You know, we saw a lot of movies this year that were explicitly mentioning, or you know, thinking something like Tar or The Menu or Glass Onion, where like COVID is part, or at least it's mentioned. Right. You know, obviously Kimmy, you know, things like that. But you put in my mind in the last few months of podcast that the idea of a COVID movie, which is sparsely populated with actors. And I was thinking Alice Darling is definitely a COVID movie, where there's basically three friends and there's a scene where they go out to dinner and like supposedly are going out like to a club. And it looks like the scene was shot against one wall on the side. And you just see like a couple people's hands go up in the air and they're like, oh, this is a COVID movie. And even Plane, to an extent, feels like a COVID movie, because the plane, again, not spoiling anything, but the plane is, there's like six people on it.
Right.
So it's one of those things where it's like, well, did they write this into the script? Like, oh, it was an overnight flight. And that's why, or did they really want to make a movie with a loaded airplane? And, then COVID happened. I don't know. I'm only speculating, but it is funny how there will be that sort of that time capsule in this like 2 year span where it's like, oh, that was a COVID movie. That was a COVID movie.
Everything COVID feels movie. Like a COVID. Even Knives Out, I mean, works COVID into it, I know. Right. But once you pull that out of it, it feels like a big movie. It has, you know, big sets and lots of production design.
Right.
But also like eight people.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like a total COVID movie. The only reason Avatar The Way of Water isn't is because they shot it like 4 years ago. So that's what you have to do now, folks. It's just the same with Top Gun Maverick, you know, just shoot your movies in the past before COVID, and then we'll get movies that feel big. Anyway, Sick is good. I really had a good time with it. And again, like I said, 80 minutes, you really can't go wrong.
Can't go wrong there. Did you see any of the other big horror offerings of the last few weeks?
Not yet. I haven't seen Megan.
Or Skinamarink.
I haven't seen Skinamarink. It doesn't. We were in a text thread with Adam where he was talking about it, and he comes down on the side of liking it. And so I want to give it a chance because I trust his taste. But the way I've heard everyone describe it, I'm like, oh, I don't know if this is for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't seen either. I've been a little boxed out by horror recently, but that's
my daughter really wants to see Megan. She doesn't want to go to the theater to see it. She's like afraid it's going to be loud. But she really wants to
fall asleep and miss something.
I'll get to her falling asleep. But she really wants to see it. So I'm hoping it's one of those that after 3 or 4 weeks, I mean, it's doing so well that I think it'll be a while before it shows up on VOD, and we'll pay the $20 rental because it would still be cheaper than all of us going to the theater. I can't justify it when it's a Nicolas Cage Western that literally only I want to see. But when it's everybody, for $20, that's fine. But so I'm waiting for it to come to VOD so I can watch it with Rosie because she really wants to see it. I feel like something big premiered on Shudder recently, but I haven't logged into Shudder probably since like Scare Package 2 came out, which I thought was just okay.
Skinamarink is going to Shudder, right? Skinamarink is Shudder.
That's what I thought. Okay.
I have to admit, I'm a seasonal Shudder subscriber.
Oh,
I know. I subscribe to Shudder for Scary Movie Month. And
that's a smart way to do it, you know.
Sorry, everybody.
Oh, it's okay. I got one more, and that is we spent the weekend in Chicago for Erica's birthday. Her birthday was last week, and we were celebrating this weekend. So we took the kids to the city. We spent the night in a hotel. We went to the John Hancock building, and we had a pool at the hotel, and we went to this restaurant that Erica's wanted to go to. And so we had all these activities planned, but our first stop was the Music Box because they've been doing this Billy Wilder retrospective, and this isn't one of the movies that he directed, but they included Ball of Fire from 1941, which is a Howard Hawks directed Billy Wilder script. And it's terrific. I had seen it before, but I was excited for Erica to see it and for the kids to watch something from 1941. Charlie liked it. Rosie went to sleep at a certain point, but woke up and liked it. And then when we were in the hotel that night, she said, "I liked it. I had no idea what was going on." It's like, well, because you slept for 40 minutes, you missed a lot of the plot. But
honestly, it's a crapshoot we all should take more often. But we're just like, I don't know, maybe if I fall asleep halfway into this, it'll be better. But like, what if I just like take a little bit? Rosie's got the right idea, I think.
She might.
Every movie is good if you only see the beginning and end of it.
I was proud of myself because I didn't start to fall asleep, because I've had that problem in movies lately, because I don't sleep very well at night at all. So I'm just always tired. So when I sit down in the dark and I'm like warm, I start to drift off. But Ball of Fire is really great. There's no Blu-ray of it, but there is a Warner Archive DVD. It's Gary Cooper and Barbara Stanwyck. I don't love Gary Cooper, but he's really good in the movie, so I'll give him a pass. He's not like one of my guys. But he's one of 8 men who are writing an encyclopedia, and Gary Cooper is in charge of the like English and grammar and all that stuff. And he realizes he messed up his chapter on slang after he meets Barbara Stanwyck. And so he wants to interview her so he can include more up-to-date slang, because she's like a nightclub singer who's hiding out from the cops. So she comes to stay with all of these guys writing an encyclopedia who've never been around a woman before, and hijinks ensue.
Sounds good. I've never seen it. I love Billy Wilder, but I've never seen this one.
Yeah, it's super good. It, you know, makes me want to go to all of the movies in this series, but it's just, it's like a 5-hour commitment to
Right.
go to any movie at the Music Box because
what
of
are the other
this week is Double Indemnity. They started with The Apartment, which Adam went to. Then they did Ninotchka, which he wrote for Lubitsch. Then they did Ball of Fire, then Double Indemnity. I don't know the exact order, but I know they're doing Ace in the Hole, Some Like It Hot, 1, 2, 3, Sunset Boulevard. And I think there's one more. I want to say there's 9 altogether. But it's an amazing series that I want to support, although they don't necessarily need my support because the screening was packed and they said this is how it's been for all of them. Yeah, people are really coming out for this series. So, but yeah, I mean, I listen to Pure Cinema and they do the calendar shows and I'm like, man, I wish I had a theater like that in Chicago. And I kind of do. I just can't go very often. You know?
I mean, that's the thing is when we get into this back and forth about like home versus theatrical and, oh, I wish we were doing this and that. And, you know, Philly, for example, you know, Philly's a much smaller film market than Chicago. But we are trying to do make more conscious efforts. The Philadelphia Film Society recently announced that they're going to be showing, I can't remember if it was 10 or 100. I can't remember of the Sight and Sound List movies. Like they're going to have screenings of the Sight and Sound List movies. Yeah. Trying to build a little bit, you know, more in terms of the film community, because our one indie chain of theaters were recently closed during COVID and they were bought back up by the Philadelphia Film Society and reopened, but it's been difficult to promote and to find programming that will get people back into the theaters and stuff like that. So I hope we do more stuff like that though. That's a really great thing to do.
Yeah,
I have a lot of Billy Wilder gaps. I'm looking through, and I mean, and I can sit here and say like, oh, he's one of my favorites, and then I'm like, hey, I haven't seen half of his movie.
There's a few that I haven't seen near the end. Oh, Private Life of Sherlock Holmes was the other one, which I'd be very curious to see with an audience. I really like that movie, but I have no idea how it will be received.
An audience would take it. Yeah.
Yeah, there's some later ones that I haven't seen. I feel like I just recently saw Avanti for the first time. What else am I thinking of? Oh, Irma LaDuce, I maybe have seen. I don't know. But man, he's got some good ones.
This is what we haven't seen.
And then at the Music Box on Monday nights, they're doing a Giallo series.
Oh.
So like tonight, they're showing an Umberto Lenzi Giallo. Next week, they're showing Tightrope. And then they're showing Lizard in a Woman's Skin on 35. And I'm like, I want to go to all of those. I know I will go to none of them. So I'm just going to try to watch them at home.
I will be there in my heart.
Saturday morning at 11:30 is a lot more doable than a Monday night at 7 because of traffic. I would need to leave my house at like 4:30.
This is one of those first world problems, but like I've had it arranged now where I can get to press screenings if they're on Tuesdays.
Okay.
And they're usually, and then they started shifting them a little bit and I was like, no, don't do that.
Yeah.
Like, come on.
Not cool, guys.
I mean, to the point where I actually emailed them and it was like, guys, can we just leave them on this night? This is, you know, like these couple nights, this is when I can go. It seemed like that was mostly during award season when they were trying to pack in as many screenings.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Now it's kind of coming back, but, yeah, no, I was just like, oh God, please just let me be able to actually go to this.
Are you going to go to the screening for Knock at the Cabin?
I am. I'm going to see
Hometown
Boy. Maybe TV's Rob might be covering that one as well.
Very nice.
Not to predict. Speaking of making movies in the past, making predictions for the future, that'll be a couple weeks out, but hopefully, possibly.
The good news is these podcasts don't last. They disappear after one week.
Yeah.
Like, and then another one comes out, and who's listening to old episodes? Anyway, so that's it for what we've seen. Let's get into Empire Records.
Let's do it.
Before
the
we
look
get
on
into
Patrick's face,
no,
right,
it's
now
totally fine. I'm just trying to figure out like how do I couch this conversation. I could not have been more excited for Empire Records in 1995. I won't say I was at the peak of my Liv Tyler obsession because I think that crests with That Thing You Do, but it's Liv Tyler is
getting
a
there.
Big reason why I want to see Empire Records in 1995. I liked the trailers. I like you know, like kind of teen movies. I like movies about groups of people. It's an Alan Moyle movie. I like to pump up the volume. I went to my high school homecoming game. This would have been my first time there as an alumni. It was maybe the second football game I had ever attended. And I left at halftime to go see Empire Records. So I just want to say, because I know one of the things we'll bring up is the fact that this movie, with the exception of Midnight in the Switchgrass, might be the lowest grossing movie we've ever covered on this movie, because this movie made $300,000.
Yeah.
Eight of those dollars were mine.
There you go, Patrick. Damn.
I'm not part of the problem, okay?
Save the Empire.
I contributed to the Empire Records gross. I didn't love it in 1995. I continue to not love it to this day. I can watch it anytime.
Yeah.
It's incredibly watchable. I've seen it probably eight times. My theory watching it this time, I was like, oh, this is 10 years later, the 90s answer to St. Elmo's Fire, which is a movie we covered a few weeks ago, a few months ago at this point.
Yeah.
Good cast, everybody doing good work. Most of them go on to bigger things. Good soundtrack, well directed, ensemble movie, multiple storylines, super watchable, does not work.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and I don't disagree with anything you're saying there. I think this is a mess. I think Empire Records is a mess of a movie, and we can talk about why that is. I unfortunately was not there opening night. Wasn't quite old enough to be there. Sorry. But I did have...
It could have grossed 300,010.
I did, though, as you did as well. I grew up playing in bands, and I had a couple bandmates, friends of mine who were a little bit older than me. I was on the younger end. I was the younger guy. And I had two friends who were obsessed with Empire Records, and they introduced me to it. And it's a movie that I just immediately fell in love with, immediately connected with, immediately. It was like, this is what I want adolescence to be. This is what I want. You know, these are those archetypes. This is, you know, this, I think like every generation has those sort of teenage hangout movies. Like you said, St. Elmo's Fire, Dazed and Confused, whatever. And I fell in love with the soundtrack. I felt all the things that were supposed to happen were supposed to happen. And it's a movie that when I put it on the other night, it started, I had those Pavlovian things went off, and I was like, oh, I know every word of this movie.
Yeah.
I know every word of this movie. And it was so surreal to be watching it, because it's not a movie I watch that often, but it was something that, and this is what we'll kind of want to think about in terms of our conversation. Couching, there's nostalgia, obviously. I mean, this wasn't my teenage experience, so I don't know what the nostalgia is for. I guess the nostalgia is just for the movie. But I keep thinking about Josie and the Pussycats, which is a movie that we both adore.
Yeah.
And if you put these two films next to each other, you could argue that in terms of success, in terms of coherent, like, here's a movie, I'm wondering if there's as much of a difference between the two of them from somebody who doesn't have explicit feelings about them. When you look at the way that Josie was kind of a flop as well, its narrative sometimes goes in certain directions, its characterization sometimes goes, which a movie I absolutely love. But I think I always had the two of them in my mind. And I thought about Josie and Pussycats a lot when I was watching this and going, why does Josie work and this one doesn't? I mean, that's sort of the question that I keep thinking about.
I mean, Josie and the Pussycats is written by clever people,
mm-hmm.
Which isn't to say I'm not trying to knock Carol Heikkinen, who's, I believe this is her first produced screenplay. I'm trying to look it up now, but yeah. Josie and the Pussycats is, oh, she wrote a couple of movies. She wrote Center Stage. She wrote The Thing Called Love, which is a really good movie. Oh, and that was actually her first produced screenplay. So ignore what I said. This is her second produced screenplay. But she really only has three credits. It's The Thing Called Love, which is a really good Peter Bogdanovich movie, Empire Records, and Center Stage. So I've seen her entire filmography. Doug wanted to do a podcast on Center Stage for years because he had a big crush on Amanda Scholl, who never came to fruition. I don't know what I would say, except
come back.
I don't like this movie. and I'm not trying to be that guy for Empire Records because people love it. And I have witnessed sort of the groundswell of affection for this movie. And there's this interesting phenomenon, you know, you were talking about nostalgia, and this is what people want their teenage years to be.
Although it's very unclear how old these people are.
Oh, it makes no sense.
It makes no sense.
Because Liv Tyler is still in high school, and then other people seem to be in their mid to late 20s. So I have no idea. I guess so AJ is also in high school because he's going to go away to college.
Thinking of going to art school, right? And is but maybe going to art school. Five.
I don't know.
Who knows?
So this interesting, and I'm not putting words in other people's mouths, but I've just, the thing that I hear about Empire Records when it comes up, and the thing that I really started to push back against, usually in my mind, sometimes verbally, was people would say stuff like, oh, that's exactly how my work was.
No, it wasn't.
And I'm always kind of like, no, I think that's how you wish your work was. And so you're remembering it that way. Like you were saying, like, this is what we wanted this time in our lives to be like. I mean, I've known people that like worked at Tower Records and they're like, that's exactly what it was like. I was like, I was at Tower Records every other day. It was not like Empire Records. Yeah. At all. There were no quarters glued to the floor.
People were not pulling guns on each other. And
well,
and
I was.
Well, all right.
You'll remember be when sorry.
When he was in fucking Warren. He was in fucking Warren. Again, I know this whole movie. We could start and I could just do a whole movie, but I won't.
Let's do it.
Remember when AJ and Deb basically start banging on the sales floor? Isn't that weird that happens?
Let me
bring that up.
It's very weird.
There's so many things in this movie that are so weird.
Well, I mean, we can't talk about it without talking about like this was sort of a studio hatchet job.
Yeah,
they cut the shit out of it, and I think that's where most of my problems lie.
It's elliptical in a bad way.
Yeah, things are introduced that come out of nowhere. Things are quickly dropped just as easily. And I'm like, oh, there could be, I assume there is a longer cut of this movie where this shit makes sense.
There's also that on DVD
remix edition.
For a long time, the only DVD that was available was the remix edition,
right?
Which sucks.
Okay, so I always read really bad reviews of the remix edition. I always wanted to check it out because I was like, is this a director's cut?
No.
So I never saw it.
Alternate takes. Stuff is in a different order. There's different songs. It's very strange. I don't have it anymore. I got the Blu-ray, and I actually look to see if it's even on there. But that was the only DVD that was available for a long time. I copied. It must have been VH1. I copied the movie off TV on a VHS tape, and when I got the DVD, I never watched it because I didn't realize it was the remix edition.
Right, right.
And I watched that thing once. I was like, this sucks. And
did the theatrical cut come out on DVD and then go out of print?
I don't know.
I have a DVD of the theatrical cut.
Okay, so then maybe that's what it was because I from my perspective, when I was looking for the DVD, I could not find it. I could only find that remix edition.
Weird.
Yeah, it might not have been a universal thing. It might have just been where I was at and what I was able to find. But it was, it was very frustrating. This movie is clearly cut to shit. This movie is clearly, I was reading, apparently it was originally in the script. It's meant to take place over 2 days, which makes more sense.
Right.
It is a movie that was found, if you can call it found in editing. right, exactly. I know.
Pasted together in editing.
Yeah. One of those movies where you're just like, I don't know, put this next to this and move this over here. And I don't know, guys, Guar wants to be in the movie. do we did this? Who shot this thing with Guar? What is this? Where did this come from?
I have big problems with the Ethan Embry performance, and I'm an Ethan Embry fan.
Sure.
I have big problems with that whole character and performance.
Is it not dramatically fleshed out in a way that
No, that's fine. He doesn't need to be. He's sort of the comic relief, which goes back to why does this movie not work in Josie and the Pussycats? Because Josie and the Pussycats is a functional comedy.
Right.
What is Empire Records? Where do you put this on the shelf?
It ostensibly is a comedy, I think.
What are the jokes?
Remember when Lucas can't get off the couch, so he holds the sofa cushion?
Right. Yeah, there's some
Rex
stuff,
Manning,
I guess,
is a joke
that we're supposed to laugh. I always had problems with the Rex Manning thing, too, because it didn't feel true to any time period. I was like, why would this guy be popular in the 90s at all? But he also doesn't feel like, I always thought he was like a weird proxy for maybe George Michael, but.
Well, right. I mean, you definitely get the sense that it's like he's an aging 80s.
Yeah, but he doesn't feel like he's from the 80s
either. Yeah, I get maybe that's just a lack of authenticity in terms of the production, because it definitely feels to me he's coded that way. I mean, it feels like,
for sure.
Like a George Michael or, you know, a Peter Gabriel or something like that. Like somebody
those
you know,
two should not be in the same sentence.
No.
Not to say just anything disparaging about either one of them, because
no,
they both,
you know,
have their,
I mean,
appeal.
Yeah. But I just mean, you know, in terms of that kind of performance and
right.
Or that kind of performer and the way that he's sort of. Yeah. But I love the way there's that scene late where they go to kick him out after he gets, you know, after all the stuff happens with Corey, and it's like, you're just washed up, you're just this, you're just that, and like like he's devastated by it.
Yeah.
And like, yeah. Debbie Mazar quits, and he's just like, where did she go? It's like, oh, that wonderful character we all cared so much about, she's gone. What? There's a point in the movie where Joe is freaking out, where Anthony LaPaglia is freaking out that Rex Manning's assistant has quit, and he's
right.
Like, what are we gonna do? What's it's like, why does it matter?
Why did she sign on to this movie? Why is Debbie Mazar in this movie and like second build?
It's such a strange movie. And again, this is a movie I watched all the time. I loved it. I still got a kick out of watching it this time. But watching it now, I'm just looking at all the pieces and going like, boy, none of this makes any sense at all.
No. And again, the performances, nothing. I think, I think Ethan Embry is mugging quite a bit.
Is that what your deal is with it?
Like, that's my objection to the performance, yeah. Because again, I like Ethan Embry and I get that he's amusing and people find him funny. And obviously he's supposed to be stoned for a lot of the movie, but they had to cut all that out.
Right.
to get the PG-13. So
I will admit to you all listening out there, didn't pick up on it. Didn't pick up on it as a kid. Was not cool enough to understand that when the dude brought him brownies and he suddenly hallucinated his way into a Guar music video, that he was high.
that is one example.
Nerd.
Oh, me too. Believe me. That's one example of a decent joke in the movie is when Eddie, who's the friend who brings him the brownies, he says, it's my special recipe. And you know what that means? Pause. Lots of sugar.
Yeah.
Which I think was an ADR. Like, I don't. I think they added that to make sense of that line so that they don't imply marijuana.
The wacky weed.
So Ethan Embry, you know, aside, I think everybody in the movie is doing their absolute best. Ethan Embry's doing his best too. Let me back up. Everybody in the movie is doing their best. I think everybody gives good performances. I think you can watch this and understand why several of them, one in particular, went on to become giant movie stars. Some of them never totally did. Johnny Whitworth, you know, continued to act, and maybe most memorably in like The Rainmaker.
Thing I've seen him in, I think.
Yeah, I know he's in other stuff, but and he's good in The Rainmaker, and he's fine in this. Who is your character proxy?
Lucas. Everybody wants to be Lucas, I feel like. Maybe it's just me. I don't know. Or, I mean, young boys, I feel like. We're not. No, I forget it. You know what I mean? Anybody can be whoever they want. I don't care. I'm not trying to be gendered. I'm just saying, when I was a kid, when I was watching it, I thought Lucas was so cool. Lucas was a, you know, he was all insecure and he was a fuck up and everything like that. And I liked his relationship with Anthony LaPaglia's character, which is really funny because when we talked about sort of the nostalgia of like wishing your life was like this. Now I relate to Joe, and I wish this is what teaching was like. It's like that's what they tell you teaching is like in movies, where it's like, oh, you got this ramshackle group of misfits, and you know, Joe is always walking around all exasperated, but he loves them and he protects them, and it's like that's what it's like. And I mean, yes, sometimes, but like for the most part, you're mostly just exasperated,
right? You're the guy who owns the Mitchell. Is that his name?
Mitchell. Yeah.
You're just that like, guy at the end of the movie where he's trying to ring people up and he's freaking out.
Yeah.
That's what teaching feels like.
Who was your proxy?
In 95, it was definitely AJ.
Okay.
Because I, you know, was constantly pining away for people and considered myself. For Liv Tyler specifically, something of romantic. Watching in 2023, it's interesting because there's so much about it that would be characterized as like, well, that's problematic now.
Super.
The way that he behaves towards Liv Tyler and, you know, he gets friend zoned and there's all these expressions for like all of the various stages that he goes through.
But I really want a girl to like me and she doesn't. And that's a problem.
Right. Exactly.
Like, wait, what?
And again, in 95, we're just like, yeah, that's how relationships work. Right.
Why won't she just be with him? Right.
And then she realizes she loves him for no fucking reason, because this movie gives her a pill addiction for one scene. Everything is bananas. She throws herself at Rex Manning because she decides she's going to. She spends at least half the movie talking about, I'm going to fuck Rex Manning. He's going to be my first. I'm going to lose my virginity to him.
It's one of the only arcs in the movie. Like, it's one of the only character things that carries from one scene to another.
She changes her mind on the turn of a dime. Like, she, I guess because he says, like, let's rock and roll. And she's like, ew, gross.
To me, I thought the implication was, oh, the way I always read it was that he basically read it as, I'm getting a blowjob. And that's not what she wanted.
I never took it that way. I was like, oh, she realized how like cheap and gross it was in that moment.
One of the things that the remix edition, maybe, and that's what I'm thinking of and how I made this connection. In the remix edition, what happens is he gets a bottle of like ranch dressing and like shakes it up, and it's like, all right, like he's basically going to put it on his dick.
What? I can't believe they cut that out of the movie. Would they have kept it in if it was Thousand Island?
But that's I think the implication is just like, well, she thought it was going to be this emotional experience, and but again, like, she's, I don't know, it's so weird, and even talking about it feels weird, and it's such a weird part of the movie, and she immediately, like you said, immediately regrets it.
I don't object to her decision to not fuck Rex Manning. Like, that makes sense and that tracks. But the way that it's handled is like with a change of a facial expression and her entire character is redefined.
Which, of course, leads me to believe that there's more on the cutting room floor somewhere.
Right.
You would hope that there's something more to that.
Suddenly she's out to lunch with Renee Zellweger. They're fighting about things that haven't been brought up in the movie. Then they're back at work and she's having a freak out.
Where the friend who brings the brownies, does Eddie work for Empire Records, or does he work for the pizza place, or does he work for
the impression he has two jobs?
Okay.
Because he comes in and kind of changes out of his pizza uniform and puts on a new shirt
into the Empire Records shirt, I guess. Although,
there's no Empire shirt. There's a Music Town uniform.
There's a Music Town
modeled by Gina,
which was a big deal for me as a kid.
Understandable. Renee Zellweger, I think, more than anyone pops off this movie. And she's given an almost unplayable character because so much of her arc comes back to like, well, she's the slut.
She's the slut. She bangs at everybody.
Right. Which, you know, I guess she fucks Rex Manning. She wears the little uniform. Nothing she does in the movie is particularly slutty.
Not really, no. And I will say my favorite bits are between her and Robin Tunney.
Yes.
And I do have to now take a moment to bring up Robin Tunney because, as you can imagine, Rob was real into Deb. Very much so. She's very much a Rob type. Shaped a lot of my early sort of fascination in terms of a certain type of young lady. I think Robin Tunney's really fun in this. And just looking back at it, looking for where that real chemistry is in the movie. I do think Anthony LaPaglia and Rory Corcoran have, like, or Cochran, excuse me, have like good scenes to get decent chemistry together. And I do think that there's those bits with Gina and Deb that are among the better actual sort of character chemistry bits in the movie. I like the way that they kind of resent each other. I mean, they're archetypes, these sort of stereotypical characters, but like they sort of resent each other, but they have a sort of mutual understanding, you know what I mean? Where there's still sort of a respect there between the two of them. And they're both sort of pissed off at Liv Tyler all the time for different reasons.
And their exchange has the best line in the movie, which is something that I still say to this day, which is shock me, shock me, shock me with that deviant behavior. I still say that to this day when it applies, when somebody's trying really hard to be, you know, so different and edgy.
Remember when they have a funeral for her?
She wants to die. Let's see her. Let's give her a real funeral. But and I like guess something... that's her arc. Does she realize she wants to live? No. It just gets interrupted.
Again, it's not really. Yeah, I mean, this movie goes to some pretty dark places, and it's like, it is treated very like real. Deb would not be cool with like, let's make fun of my ideation with a funeral. Like, that's not okay. And
it
that's
doesn't. And again, Alan Moyle did this with Pump Up the Volume. Like, he combines genuine teenage concerns with like a cool soundtrack and some real drama. And so I can see why this script attracted him. Because I think it plays to some of his strengths, but whether he fucked it up or whether it's just a result of the studio gutting it, it's like the stuff about the pill addiction, the stuff with her trying to kill herself, all of that is played with less dramatic stakes than like, will AJ get the girl? Will Warren get hired at Empire Records? You know, it's all an even field, and that doesn't work.
I mean, I'm just reading, you know, three significant characters and up to 40 minutes were removed from the film.
Who are the characters? I assume Debbie Mazar.
Are there three more people who work at this place? Because I love the scenes. This is was laughing so much watching us going, like, thinking of obviously the way, you know, things are today. And like most of what's happening is happening in the back room. And it's just teenagers just sitting around and like sketching. And not to say that teenagers don't still waste time and that they don't. Retails, okay, there's too many people working tonight or whatever, but I just kept thinking to myself as characters kept coming into the store, I was like, he works here too, she works here too, they're all in the same shift and nobody's doing any work. And then there's that funny bit where Ethan Embry's out there, not funny, but you know, he's out there doing the cash register by himself.
Yeah,
and I was like, oh, there you go, okay, well, at least they picked up on that.
Right.
I don't know. And again, I'm sure there are a lot of people right now who are listening to this and they really wanted an Empire. They wanted the Chris Farley show. They wanted an Empire Records love fest because they love this movie. And I swear to you folks, I love this movie too. But I love it for reasons that have nothing to do with its integrity as a story. It is weird and strange and such an interesting artifact. And one of the reasons why, knowing that Patrick doesn't like this movie, I wanted to do a show on it was because I thought it was still worth having a conversation about this kind of movie and what in particular, because again, we typically do shows about these kinds of movies.
Yeah.
Like this is very much a Patrick and Rob show where it's like, well, no, these are the kind of movies that we talk about. But this one, I mean, again, I can agree with you on this one. Like it as a movie, it just doesn't work. It doesn't make any sense. But it's so fascinatingly bad in that regard, because again, I do feel like there's a ton of charisma in this movie. It's insanely quotable. As you said, it's insanely watchable. And yet there is just something so fundamentally wrong with it.
Well, it's like watching an episode of like an early season of Friends where you're just like, I can leave this on and it's super watchable. I like hanging out with these people.
Exactly.
None of this adds up to much. There aren't any real arcs. I mean, it has, you know, essentially the dramatic weight of a sitcom, an episode of a sitcom. None of it really adds up to anything, but it's super easy to have on and hang out to.
And like you pick any character. It's like, all right, Joe. All right. So Joe, what's Joe? Okay. Well, Joe's thing is he runs the store.
He's hiding an Australian accent.
He's hiding an Australian accent. He's still learning the drums. He's got he's got the tightness. You can tell he's an actor who's trying to learn. I know it's Nancy LaPaglia, but as a drummer, I can identify other drummers, and he's not a drummer. But he learned at least enough to be camera ready for this movie. His deal is Lucas stole the money. Lucas stole last night's take. Got it. He now needs to make up for that, or Lucas will go to jail. Got it. He's going to make up for it by taking out a personal loan, maybe, or he says he had money that he was saving to make Mitch an offer to buy Empire Records.
Yeah.
The amount of money in question is about what, $7,000?
Nine grand.
What he was going to offer?
I couldn't fucking believe on this rewatch that I'm like, wait a second, this whole thing. This thing lives or dies by $9,000?
Yes.
That's a lot of money. If somebody was like, can you have $9,000? I would say no. I'm not trying to downplay how much $9,000 is. But when you're talking about the future of a business.
That's what I'm trying to say, which is, okay. So then it's like, all right, well, I have to now dip into my stash that I was going to save to pay him off to make us square again. But then never mind. We're going to have a show where Burko and his band are going to play Sugar High. We're going to make $9,000 in a night. And then we're going to give that money to Mitch and then convince him to sell Joe the store. It just doesn't really, like, it just, when you really think about it, it's just like, wait a minute, nothing makes sense here. I don't get this.
It kind of always bothered me, and maybe it shouldn't. Maybe I'm like missing the point, and people who love this movie can explain to me the point. I was always waiting for the scene. I wanted a scene where he kind of says, I was trying to save this place, and I fucked up, and I'm sorry. And maybe we don't need that, because to Joe, it doesn't matter why he needed the money. He doesn't need to know. It's none of his business. Maybe it's a better, more mature movie than I'm giving it credit for. But I, as a viewer, I always wanted that catharsis. I don't know why.
Yeah, the movie skips over so much of that to just get to the concert at the end. And, you know, we're formed by a
guy named Coyote Shivers, which
Coyote Shivers
is he's Burko. Playing Burko, and I wish his name was not Coyote Shivers, and maybe he's one of the three main characters, because I never understand his relationship. Like, I think he's got a thing with Deb.
There's the whole thing early on about him and Deb, and it's like he maybe was a problematic boyfriend or did something that may have provoked her issues, and then she says it's not about you, and that sort of arc is never really followed up upon.
As much as I loved Liv Tyler in this movie, and still, you know, do when I watch it, when Renee, I'm a bigger fan of Renee Zellweger specifically in this movie, and then when she sings at the end, it's like, holy shit.
Yeah, and that, by the way, her verse is not in Sugar High.
No, by the soundtrack, not there. I've owned it on cassette and CD.
And it's just like, but that's the best part. Where is it?
Yeah.
Do a live version. You should have put a live version of the song on that soundtrack.
Can you imagine, by the way, if you're Anthony LaPaglia and you learn drums to that ACDC song, and then this movie makes $300,000.
That's the Josie and the Pussycats problem all over again. real quick as we wrap
Crikey.
Up.
I learned drums for this one.
Sorry, that's my Anthony LaPaglia.
It's a good one. I think.
Thanks. Thank you.
Best song on this soundtrack?
I mean, it's not on the soundtrack, but I love the song that ends the movie, This Is the Day.
Yeah.
I like that Gin Blossom song. I like the song that plays when Deb is shaving her head.
Yeah. Free by the Martinis.
What is the best song on this album?
I'm with you. I was gonna say Free and then Sugar High. If Sugar High had the Renee Zellweger verse,
then it's a no brainer.
Yeah, then it's a no brainer. But yeah, but just little things. I don't know. I like this movie, but I do have to admit, like, there's just so many strange things about it that puts it on a lower tier, of these movies that we primarily have memories of in terms of nostalgia and in terms of the charisma element, I think, carries a lot of this, but
yeah.
It's so incredibly disjointed and so incredibly strange. And It was just really kind of surreal to watch at this time. It was very, very interesting.
I'm happy for them that it has gone on to become a cult hit. It certainly deserves better than the fate that it got, both in terms of the studio's re-edits or just edits, mm-hmm. and the $300,000 box office. Like, yeah. That's bananas. Way worse movies have made way more money. So I'm glad that there's sort of a happy ending and people remember this movie very favorably, and it means a lot to a lot of people. I think that's great.
Yeah, agreed.
Thank you guys very much for listening to this episode. We have a Patreon. Go to patreon.com/fthismovie for more kick-ass F This Movie content. There will be a bonus episode up in the next week or two with me and Erica bullshitting. And go to fthismovie.com every day for cool shit. Read Rob's Alice Darling review later today. Follow us on Twitter at FThisMovie, Facebook, YouTube, where reserved seating appears every Thursday, and email us at FThisMoviePodcast@gmail.com. Thank you, Rob.
Damn the man. Save the Empire.
Thanks for listening to F This Movie.